She might have heard the crack of Sukru's whip, but it was so soft she couldn't be sure. She gripped her right hand, feeling the burn from the old wound. She'd become adept at recognizing when it was flaring, and she had started to master suppressing the pain and the anger that often came with it. They were reflections of the Asirim, their anger, their sorrow. There was a time when it would have overwhelmed her, but she'd learned how to distance herself from them. She did so now, closing herself off to the Asirim, especially to those nearing the city. As another wail came, she used it to mask the soft creak of the right shutter as she pulled it back. After making sure there were no maidens along this section of the wall, she launched the spool of thread through the window. It arced into the chill air, easily clearing the wall. Then it was Chaida's turn. She crouched on the sill, pulled the shutter nearly closed, and leapt down to the parapet. Gathering slack from the spool below, she lay the string carefully so that it hugged the surface of the stone walkway, ran at a right angle up to the crenellation, and then to the battlement's outer edge. Satisfied that no one would easily spot it, she slithered through the crenel and dropped to the ground, absorbing the impact with a perfectly timed roll. Choosing a path among the scrub bushes that would hide her movements, she moved fast and low away from the wall. Then she stood and began jogging up the slope toward the top of Toriat. The darkened city sprawled below her as she skirted the palaces along the slope. She heard crashing sounds coming from the north, then screams, which were quickly cut short. She could feel the hunger of the Asirim who had come to feast, but was grateful she felt it only distantly. Had she not closed herself off to them, she would feel not only their unfiltered glee as they murdered the living, but the self-loathing that always followed. On she went, passing palace after palace, Kulishans, Isans, Yusans. Eventually she was higher than even Eventide, King Kiral's palace. As the moons approached their zenith, the slope began to ease, and she reached level ground. The city below was now a mottled black blanket, the desert beyond a roll of unfurled silk. A rocky promontory, the very peak of Toriat, lay only a few hundred paces away. Nearer, larger rocks surrounded a clearing. She approached it with care, nervous, though she knew not why. She thought she heard someone speaking in the distance. She peered into the gloom, moved to one side to get a better look around one large stone, but found the clearing empty. She glanced up at the bright moons and realized the sounds were coming from above, as if the goddesses were holding a conversation in secret. She tried to pick out the words, but it was like a leaf tumbling in the wind, one long susurrus. The words indistinguishable. When she took a step closer to the clearing between the stones, however, the whispers grew tantalizingly close. She heard a word, fields, then weather. It reminded her of nothing so much as Sahid Allah's. When they had met in the night darkened streets of Sharakai, he'd been standing close enough to touch, reciting part of a poem. Unmade, he'd said, then betrayed, and fallen. And the clearest of them all, rest will he, neath twisted tree. She recalled the pain and wonder she'd seen in his face. The curse laid upon him by the gods forbade him from speaking of such things, and yet he had found the strength to do it. This, Chaida realized. The whispers are what my mother came for. The silver trove. She took another step forward, more curious, more eager than she'd been in years. I'm afraid I can't allow you to go any farther. A dark figure resolved from the stones to her left. Chaedor took a step back and drew River's daughter.
That won't be necessary.
She knew that voice, that lilting tone. King Isan. As he stepped closer, she recognized his slight build, the way he clasped his hands before him when he walked. The thread of gold in his dark clothing reflected the moonlight. The gemstone in his turban sparkled.
Before we go any further, Chedamin.
He waved toward River's daughter.
Sheath your sword.
There was power in the timbre of his words, and with it came a desire to obey. She resisted, but it led to an indescribable discomfort inside her. Like stones being stacked on a pane of glass, the tension grew, threatening to break her from within. And when she became desperate and thought to lift the sword to stop him, the pain became bright as the burning sun. Only when she'd slid her blade home did it ease. His smile shone in the moonlight.
I wondered when you'd come. I must say I thought it would have been before now. Now back away. The two of us should have a chat, but free of the whispers.
Again came the feeling of power and the desire to obey. She saw no reason to refuse him, and wondered if that was part of his power to make her think it was her idea to begin with, or at least to make it unobjectionable. She backed away until the feeling of tension eased. Isan followed calmly, as if he had expected nothing less.
You've been a particularly sharp thorn in the side of the kings. Two dead by your hand, another nearly taken by a poisoned arrow. The same king nearly felled by your own blade some months later.
Don't tell me you're surprised. You knew, and allowed me to remain in the House of Maidens. You had Said train and advise me.
In the moonlight, Isan's smile looked beatific. He waved back the way Chaedor had come.
You'd have enjoyed the fury in the House of Maidens when they learned of your treachery.
Melisse was angry, though no more than one would expect.
Camille was murderous. Sumeya, however, was inconsolable, which was rather surprising given how even-handed a commander she had been. It makes me wonder what you meant to her.
Chaedor's mind flashed to the night she had lain on the sand with Sumeya, the two of them kissing, their skin hot on that cold winter night.
She launched an inquisition, Isan went on. Every single blade maiden was questioned. Their past inspected carefully. The Heb was in attendance for many of them, in hopes of ferreting out untruths. They managed, in fact, to uncover one who had been feeding information to Malasan for years. Sumeya flayed her personally in the maiden's courtyard for all to see, though I rather think she wished it were you being lashed beneath her whip. And then there was Indris. Baki's bright hammer.
Yes, Isan said, perhaps noticing her reaction.
Indris recovered. She was gleeful to be proven right about you. She's still not fully healed, especially in her mind. She was always a cruel child, but now she's twisted. So twisted, Sumeya almost refused to take her back.
Chaedor had no idea why he was telling her this, but at the moment she didn't much care.
How did you know I would come?
Isan waggled his finger at her like a scolding father.
No, no. Oh, white wolf. The night is already half past, and there are things I must learn from you, such as where you've been since leaving Sharikai.
Then let's trade for it. There are things I would know as well. Things that would help me to take down Honor. A thing I suspect you'd very much like to see happen.
What do you know?
He asked sharply. She was compelled, but it was no great hardship for her to share how she had left Sharakai, had she been taken by Honor. Much of it he would already know, but she spent a good amount of time telling him how angry Honor had been, how eager he seemed for revenge against all the kings, but especially Isan. Isan considered this.
We'll come back to Honor.
There are things I need to know about the riot at the southern harbor first. Just before you quelled the riot, you said you went to the ship to free the Blazing Blues. I believe your excuse was that you saw one escaping the hold. When told of a woman with plaited blonde hair walking unobstructed through the crowd, you reported that you hadn't seen her. But you did see her. Didn't you?
Yes. Who was she?
The goddess Nalame.
Isan paused, a thoughtful smile on his lips.
Well, well. The goddess incarnate, walking along the quays of the southern harbor. You spoke to her, did you not?
No, Chayda said. She walked toward the ship, knowing I would see her. I knew in that moment that there would be something in that ship for me to find, something to help quell the riot. I wanted to speak with her, but by the time I made it to the hold, she was nowhere to be found.
The riot wasn't the first time you'd seen Nalame, was it?
No, she said. I saw her when I was young. It felt like a terrible betrayal. My mother took me to see her several times, and once she showed me visions in her tree.
It's quite a riddle, isn't it? Nalame of all the gods.
He waved toward the clearing.
Missing from this very place that night so long ago. She refused to come when all the other gods did. And what has she done since? She's been hounded, reborn, made anew over the course of centuries.
Isan paused, staring at her, as if he could hear her thoughts whispering like the voices in the clearing behind him.
Tell me about the visions.
There are many. I saw them in the glass that hung from the acacia in her garden. I saw the Knight of Endless Swords. I saw River's daughter being handed to me by Husamitin. I saw my mother giving birth, alone and ashamed. I only knew the goddess as Celaya then, and I think that's how she saw herself as well. When I told her about my visions, she seemed as shocked as I was. I think she was using me to...
Chayda felt like she'd been struck by lightning. Isan frowned.
Go on.
It's why she sent my mother away.
What do you mean?
She was using me to find herself,
Chayda said, as confident about this as anything she'd ever learned about Nalame.
I think what she saw led her to a choice. On the surface, it was to take me at my mother's request or refusal. In truth, though, I think she was finding her way, stumbling forward like the blind woman she was.
Isan remained silent as he searched her face, but for the moment, Chayda didn't care what he thought. She could still see the look of shock on her mother's face when Celaya told her to return to Sharakai. She remembered the cold calculation, the resignation.
That was the morning after she came here to find the Silver Trove. That was the night she met you, wasn't it?
Isan nodded, transfixed by what Chayda was telling him.
I thought you might have lured her here with lies.
Chayda waved to the clearing beyond Isan.
But now I know they're true.
She considered Isan's presence, and more pieces fell into place.
You come here to guard them, to make sure no one can hear Tulathan's words.
Isan remained perfectly still.
In a manner of speaking.
Jada's mind was afire, pulling together the clues, picturing everything that had happened during those two fateful days.
When she came, you stopped her before she came near enough to hear the whispers. She learned they were Tulathan's poems, and you worried my mother had learned too much. So you compelled her to return to the House of Kings the following night.
For the first time, Isan seemed surprised by her assertions. His expression had shifted. He seemed wary, perhaps wondering just how much she knew. A wiser woman might have stopped there, but Chada refused to. She had come this far, and she wanted to know more. She needed to know more. She'd never have this chance again.
You sent her to kill Azhad.
The wariness on Isan's face turned feral. He displayed a hunger that would more look natural on a man disposed to violence, like King Sukru or Kahil.
I did,
he said simply, as if here and now, just this once, he could admit it. For so long, Chada had thought herself a piece on an Aban board, with moves being made by the likes of Isan and Masid and Hamzakir. She thought she might rise to make moves of her own, but after all she and Isan had discussed, she felt as if the kings were pieces as well. How could she rise above her station when it was the gods themselves playing the game? In the city, an Asir howled. On and on it went, sounding very much like a woman crying.
Why have you come here? Chada asked, suddenly and keenly interested in the answer.
Isan seemed confused by the question.
My reasons are my own.
I doubt you've been sent by the other kings.
He looked past Isan to the clearing, all but ignoring him.
You must want to come. I wouldn't be surprised if you come most holy nights, but why would a king scratch at a wound so? She looked to him. Does shame force your hand?
And then she saw something most amazing. Shock in the eyes of the honey-tongued king. Shock, which meant she was right. He did feel shame. About it all. Bet-Iman, the Asirim, all that had happened since.
Is that why you wish to remove the other kings from this mountain? To help you forget your own shame?
Be quiet.
It won't work, she said, stepping past him.
Stop!
He roared.
She felt the physical need to obey, but in that moment the Asirim in the city felt so near that she went against her earlier promise. She drew upon their sorrow, their unending anger, heedless of whichever kings might sense her presence. Her right hand flared with bright pain. She drove forward, and the power of Isan's words grew, as did the pain. A deep ache seared her joints and muscles, her skin lit a fire, and she came closer to hearing more of Tulathan's poems, enough that she heard more from the spectral whispers,
Weep!
And Desert Deep.
But when Isan shouted,
Cease!
Her body obeyed. She willed herself to move, focused on listening to the whispers, but it was impossible. Her body was screaming in pain. There was pity in the Asir, but bitter amusement as well.
What did you expect, favored of Sahid Alaz?
Isan's footsteps neared. He entered her field of vision, his face a mask of fury.
Step back, child.
She did. The whispers faded.
Take the kinsha from your belt.
She tried to deny him. Her right hand was afire with the effort. And still she drew the curving knife and held it before her, as if she were offering it to him.
Now hold the tip to your breast.
That's it. Very good, child.
Now draw it towards you.
With both hands holding the point of the kensha to her chest, she pulled, using ever more force. The knife forced its way through the boiled leather of her fighting dress, then pierced the skin between her breasts. Her breath came rabbit-quick. The pinpoint of pain was surrounded by a growing sense of warmth as blood seeped from the wound.
Enough, Isan said,
and she complied, keeping the point of the knife where it was.
You are not without your usefulness, Chedamin, but I will hurry your departure to the farther fields should you disobey me again.
Sweat rolled down her face, chill in the cold night breeze.
You said it yourself. We both work toward Onor's death. So let us make a bargain, you and I. I'll give you his bloody verse. Then you will return to the desert and take his head. Return to me with it, and I'll tell you a thing you've been most eager to learn.
Chayda hardly dared speak. And what is that?
Why, the name of your father.
With sudden clarity, she felt the wind across her face, felt it tug at the tail of her turban. She felt the vastness of the desert open up around her, though instead of feeling like something small, she felt powerful in a way she never had before.
Give me Onor's weakness.
Isan smiled, a fox before the vole.
Our good king was given a terrible, unending hunger for flesh of many sorts, but foremost among them the flesh of man. In order to feast, he changes shape most often into a panther, with skin as black as night. It is a thing you should be wary of when approaching him, for he is terrible in that form. But once he gives in to his temptation and feasts, he is weakened, often for days. Find him then, and he will be yours.
He took her head in his hands and kissed her on the lips, stared deeply into her eyes, and she felt a deep will to please him.
Go, he said, releasing her. Fulfill your duty and return to me.
She stepped away. Turning, she slipped her kensha into its sheath with familiar ease, then jogged back down Toriat. She never looked back, not once. She was still filled with the fire of Isan's command. But there was also a growing awareness along the edge of her consciousness. An Asir, a broken woman with shriveled black skin, was now limping toward the blooming fields under the crack of Sukru's whip. A host of nightmares, memories of things the Asir herself had committed, haunted her. They haunted Chayda as well, sobered her, made her aware of what she was doing in a way she might never have been otherwise.
We are slaves to the same master, you and I,
the Asir said to her.
No, we are not,
Chayda said, as she jogged along the moonlit path.
You grant me the wisdom to see my plight, and the strength to disobey, and for that I am in your debt.
She felt a sour sort of satisfaction from the Asir.
Go then, child. Go and see our people freed.
Chapter 30. Cheda crept ever closer to the House of Maidens' interior wall. She took great pains to move soundlessly, but knew she couldn't tarry. The moons had set, and the only light to speak of was the occasional brazier spaced along the wall, but dawn was not far off. After watching two maidens pass the wall on their rounds, she rushed to the silk thread she had left behind where it hung down from the wall above. She pulled on it, which drew the coiled rope out from the window of Sayabim's office. She climbed the rope hand over hand, gained the parapet, and swung over to the Hall of Records. Instead of climbing up to the window, however, she dropped to the ground. She couldn't leave the House of Maidens. Not yet. She had one final task to perform before she returned to the tunnels in the Savasham. She was glad for the cloak of darkness around her as she padded along the wall and the paved path to the barracks. When she reached the large courtyard that separated the Hall of Records from the barracks, she pulled her veil from her face and allowed it to hang down. Maidens didn't wear veils unless they were on duty, so while it felt as if she were announcing her presence to every maiden and matron within these walls, she let it be and walked with her head held high. She was sure one of the maidens on the western wall saw her, but no cry of alarm was raised as she entered the building that had been her home for nearly a year. When she reached the top floor, the topmost story, she pulled out a pair of woolen socks and slipped them over her boots. Silently, she slipped through the archway that led to her old apartments. Just inside was a communal sitting room and an area with a central hearth that doubled as a cooking space. A table with chairs sat in one corner. She made her way slowly but steadily down the left-hand hallway which led to Sumeya's, Camille's and Manise's rooms. All three were light sleepers, but Cheda took care to make no sound and, fortunately, Manise's room was first. She peered through the beaded curtain. It was too dark to see her, but Cheda could hear Melisse's soft breathing. Light snoring came from the next room, Camille's. She heard nothing from the doorway at the end of the hall. It was too far to hear Sumeya's breathing, but that worked in both directions. Sumeya was the lightest sleeper of them all. With movements slow as the dunes, Cheda parted the beaded curtain. The beads clacked softly as she inched into the room. Once she was past them, she listened to Melissa's breathing with one hand on River's daughter, ready to draw it if need be. She heard no change, however, as she took out the folded note she'd prepared before coming to the city. With the utmost care, she slipped it into the small leather bag halfway up the shelf near the window. It was the one that kept Melissa's toiletries, her scented soap, her pomace stone, the sheaf of frayed twigs she used to clean her teeth. It was the safest place Cheda could think of, and there was no other reasonable way to speak to Melisse in private and share what she knew. Of all the maidens, Melisse was the likeliest to believe her. The very thought of Melisse doing as Cheda asked seemed preposterous now that she was here, but what was there to do about it anymore? After tucking the note away, she reversed her steps, parted the curtain, and slipped back toward the entrance. Only when she reached the doorway did she begin to breathe easier. She had just pulled the woolen socks from her boots and stepped out from the apartments when she came face to face with another maiden. Sumeya. Cheda was already in motion. She used her foot and forward momentum not to debilitate, but to shove Sumeya as far as she could. Sumeya expelled a breathy whoosh as she was propelled backward. She gasped for air as Cheda sprinted in the opposite direction. Assassin! Sumeya bellowed, then whistled the call to bring the barracks to arms. Jada heard Sumeya give chase, but she dared not look back. Soon she reached the end of the covered walkway. There she launched herself up to the mud brick railing and through the air toward the opposite barracks. She bounded against the rough exterior, leaping back toward the building she'd just leapt from. She nearly missed the lip of the roof, but once she had it, she slipped over the top. Below she heard Sumeya's grunt as she leapt from the same railing. Jada had not gone 5 strides before Sumeya landed on the roof behind her. She sprinted hard after Jada, giving another piercing whistle.
Enemy, moving west.
Jada sprinted to the corner of the roof and leapt for another building. Below she spotted 3 dark shapes rushing for the curtain wall that separated the House of Maidens from the city. As she ran, Jada spread her awareness. On the wall to her left, more maidens ran toward her position, hoping to cut her off. To her right, one maiden had stopped, a bowstring drawn to her ear. Jada felt for the maiden's heartbeat, felt her outward breath, and ducked and rolled as the arrow released. The arrow whizzed overhead, biting into the roof on Jada's left. Jada was up again in a flash, but Sumeya was close now, and Jada could feel her searching for Jada's heart, hoping to make her stumble or, at the very least, distract her. But she had been caught off guard by Jada's sudden appearance, and Jada had been prepared for this. It was child's play to elude Sumeya. As Jada neared the edge of the barracks, 5 maidens were converging on the curtain wall, as the maiden on the wall drew another arrow. She aimed, waiting for Jada to land. Jada withdrew a packet from inside her dress, one she had prepared herself under Dadzada's strict guidance. She squeezed it hard, heard the crunch as the glass vial within broke, and released its liquid contents into the powder surrounding it. Fixing the placement of the wall and battlements in her mind, Jada threw it for all she was worth, then leapt from the barracks. The packet struck, and the area around it was consumed in a billowing black cloud. Jada flew through open air and was swallowed by it. She landed, felt something bite into her shin, heard the arrow skitter somewhere off to her left. Gritting her teeth against the pain, she felt her way into a crenellation and leapt blindly. She knew these buildings well. She'd walked them many times on guard duty. She knew the pattern of streets and buildings that lay ahead, some of the oldest in Sharakai. So she landed easily on the nearest of the buildings and rolled away, finally emerging from the dense black fog created by the packet. She threw another. The smoke billowed as 2 sets of footsteps thumped along the rooftop behind her.
Blood traitor! You'll not escape! Not this time!
Gods, it was Camille. Jada glanced back and saw her arm snap forward. A throwing knife spun through the air, glinting in the moonlight. Jada tried to dodge, but it bit deeply, piercing her shoulder through the armor of her dress. The knife clattered against the clay tiles as she entered the second cloud. Making as little noise as possible, she dropped from the edge of the roof. She landed hard, tweaking her ankle as she rolled. Gritting her teeth against the pain, she headed toward an alley that led in drunken fashion toward the temple district. As the bells in the House of Maidens continued to ring, she heard someone drop behind her, heard the flutter of cloth as someone flew through the air and landed on the building above her as well. Sumeya and Camille, one running high, the other low. Jada ran for all she was worth, but Camille was catching up. She drew River's daughter, knowing she couldn't outrun her. Camille was too strong, too fast. Jada had just reached the end of the alley, where it emptied onto Raven Road. She'd decided on this escape path days ago. Thankfully, she was still on it. She waited until the last possible moment, then spun and met Camille's Shamshir with her own. The two of them traded several blinding blows, each searching for a quick advantage over the other. Chayda felt Camille reaching for her heart, but this had never been Camille's gift. Chayda thwarted her, turned the advantage against Camille, and pressed on her heart. But Camille was so strong she powered through it, sending blow after blow against Chayda's defenses. The tide was turning against her, and now Chayda heard someone drop to the ground behind her. Sumeya. Chayda quickly retreated, ducking a blow from Sumeya, rolling away and coming up while blocking a downward chop from Camille. She maneuvered over the cobblestone street, trying to keep one of them between her and the other, but they were so used to working with one another, they foiled her at every turn. She tried to turn the tables on them, to take the offense, but they gave her no chance. It was all she could do to fend off their blades. Behind Camille and Sumeya, more blade maidens were dropping to the street, and then Chayda heard heavy footsteps pounding along the street behind her, much heavier than any maiden would make, and the heartbeat was loud and strong, almost ox-like. Sumeya broke away, raising her free hand to the newcomer.
Halt! By order of the kings!
Camille, meanwhile, unleashed a series of moves that were too fast and powerful for Chayda to match.
For murdering Misut, my father, Camille called.
Chayda's sword was driven aside as Camille's foot came up in a swift roundhouse kick that took Chayda on the side of her head.
You will die a thousand deaths.
Chayda stumbled, barely defending against a hammer-like blow.
And I swear, I'll be there to witness them all.
The heavy footsteps were close. Chayda turned to see a bulky form, wrapped in a voluminous thorb, throw something at Camille. Camille warded her free arm before her. Something struck her hand in a burst of bright light. A series of small explosions pounded the air, and the street brightened. Chayda felt them all. They shook her insides. They rattled her bones. She was supposed to have closed her eyes, but she had forgotten, and now she was dizzy and blinded. She scrabbled away, finding it hard to find her balance. Dardzada's strong hands lifted her, helped her to stumble onward. The world kept tilting in odd ways, making her nauseous. Dardzada kept her upright, though, kept her moving steadily away from the maidens. When they had run several streets, Chayda heard Sumeya call,
There! Down there! Find them!
That was when Dardzada led her down a set of stairs to a cellar door. He opened it soundlessly, led Chayda inside, then closed and barred the door. After picking up a loaded crossbow leaning against the wall and pointing it toward the door, he waited, listening for sounds of pursuit. Chayda vomited on the cellar floor.
Be quiet!
Dardzada hissed. The sound of footsteps grew stronger, then a hushed conversation. Finally, thank the gods, the sounds faded. Dardzada led her to the rear of the cellar, where a set of stairs led up. Instead of taking them, however, he went beneath them, where a false wall led to a small room stocked with food and water, enough to last for days. Two pallets lay ready at the far side of the small space.
We're going to get to know this room well, aren't we?
Dardzada pointed to the door with the crossbow.
Eat that, or take our chances out there.
This will do nicely.
Chapter 31 King Isan leafed through the journal he had been reading these past many days. It was Yusam's and almost a decade old. Like so many of his entries, there were notes from more recent times, visions that Yusam cross-referenced and embellished, or sometimes thoughts that had occurred to him years later.
The moonless host, trapped in the city, this entry read. Dozens. Masid Ishikawa among them. Perhaps his father as well. Several hands of maidens give chase along the quay, or perhaps on the sand of the northern harbor. The vision was unclear here. They capture or kill all but Masid, and a young scarab, handsome with striking eyes and a black beard. The two of them escape on a skiff. Beside it was a diamond shape, which indicated that this entry was a recurrence. Below that was written, "Seen again, yet this time they are born from the city on the wings of an old grey gull." Each note had numbers, cross-referencing the year, volume number and page where the full entries to the related visions could be found. Isan shoved the journal away.
"You are nothing if not organized," he said softly.
Perhaps that was what drove him to distraction and would have driven him mad if he had lived. Isan had seen it in him in recent years, how flighty he had become, how difficult it was for him to concentrate on anything for more than a few minutes. As useful as the notes and cross-references were, maybe if he had relaxed his vision a bit and let the larger, more important things come to him, he'd still be alive. After downing a healthy swallow of cucumber-infused water, he pulled the journal and again worked his way forward. The vision of the skirmish in the northern harbor had been mentioned in another entry about a battle in the desert, which had leapt to another. A particularly vivid vision from the mirror. Yusam always noted these sorts of visions. Those, he felt, were of the greatest import to the kings and Sharakai, with a mark beside the entries, and then duplicated them in special journals. Most of his journals were backed with mundane leather, but these were robin's egg blue, and so had come to be known as the blue journals. This particular vision was of a blade maiden who stood in a mountain fastness. Many were held up in that fortress. An army, too large to defend against despite the fortress's stout walls, approached along the valley. The maiden, and here Yusam noted that the woman may only have been dressed as a maiden, then further clarified in the margins that perhaps she had once been a maiden, along with a cross-reference to yet another journal. This possible maiden spoke with a tall woman with plaited blonde hair holding a yew-staff.
"Nalame," was scribbled below it. "Save us," the maiden said. "If I do, all we've done may fade into the desert." "We have need now," the maiden replied. "Too many will die if we do not act."
And here Yusam did something rare. He was often clinical in his descriptions, but there were times when he felt something, emotions, even memories from those in the visions. He wrote that the woman had experienced deep sorrow, even fear. She was desperate, as if she knew her fate and would meet it to protect those she loved.
"A thing that feels familiar," Yusam had written in the margins, and put a mark beside it with yet another cross-reference.
What it was that felt familiar, he never said. The simple feeling of desperation. The cross-reference, a journal written only months ago, was one Isan had yet to read. He jotted the date down on the slip of paper he kept, noting all the journals he needed to retrieve from Yusam's palace. It was enough, he decided. He had nearly 20 more journals to find and bring back with him. He ordered his vizier, Tolovan, to prepare his carriage and was soon trundling over King's Road to the Hall of Records below Yusam's palace. An hour later, he reached the anteroom outside the archives, where shelf upon shelf of ancient texts and manuscripts were kept. Sitting at the desk, looking a bit haggard, was Yusam's daughter, Lien, who had been indispensable in teaching Isan,
Usam's idiosyncrasies and helping to find related visions that he hadn't cross-referenced. Lien had read every journal, most more than once, and many a dozen times or more, especially the blue journals.
"Are you well?" Isan asked her.
"Yes, excellent. It's..."
She smiled, visibly calming herself.
"How may I serve?"
He slid the paper across the desk.
"Here's what I'll need today."
Lien's grey-green eyes narrowed as she squinted through her narrow spectacles. She began to frown as her finger trailed down the list. The lower her finger went, the deeper the frown became.
"My apologies, my Lord King, but I cannot bring these to you."
"Oh?"
Lien was neither young nor easily cowed, but she looked now like a woman who'd been brought before the kings for the first time.
"They've already been taken."
Isan was irritated, but a growing sense of dread quickly replaced it. There were only a handful of reasons why Lien would act this way.
"Who took them?"
When she spoke, she gave him the very answer he feared.
"The King of Kings," she said. "He arrived an hour ago, and his spears took them away."
"These journals," Isan said, pointing to the list.
"These and 100 more."
100?
Lien looked chagrined.
"And all of the blue journals."
For a moment, Isan was speechless. Part of him was furious, but another part actually admired Kiral's boldness. It was exactly what Isan would have done in his place.
"Kiral came for them himself?"
Her eyes wandered to the archway behind Isan.
"He did."
Isan turned to see Kiral's square frame approaching from the archives. Behind him, several servants were wheeling a cart with dozens of leather-bound journals, similar to the ones Isan had been reading these past many weeks. Their spines were stamped with Usam's seal, the sun rising above the horizon, rays of sunlight spreading over the sky.
"Curse you for a fool, Isan. If Kiral has come himself, then he's stumbled onto something. A trail similar to my own. Perhaps the very same one."
He nearly laughed at the irony of it all. He thought of doing exactly what Kiral was doing now, order a goodly potion of the archive to be brought to his palace. But he hadn't wanted to draw attention to his activities. That was why he'd informed the other kings he was reading the journals. Hiding it would only make them wonder what was so important, but admit it to their faces and they'd think nothing of it. It had worked, too. He'd had weeks of unrestricted access thus far, and little reason to think it wouldn't continue. Until today. He had been a fool to think he was the only one hoping to mine Usam's visions for glimpses of the future.
"Isan," Kiral said.
"Kiral."
He motioned to the retreating carts. "I didn't take you for a man who enjoyed such fanciful narratives."
"I warn you, the story wanders and the characters seem a bit shallow."
Kiral looked like he was teasing a canker inside his cheek.
"You have more of Usam's journals at your palace."
Always to the point, it was his most grating aspect.
"One or two." 27,
Kiral shot back. Lien must have told him.
"I had hoped to learn more from them than I have."
Behind Kiral, another cart trundled out from the archives and headed for the exit.
"What have you learned so far?" "That I would have gone mad had I been gifted with a mirror."
Kiral sucked his teeth.
"This has always been the trouble with you. The jackals could be storming the walls, and you would rain quips down upon them.
What is life without humor?
You may have missed your calling, Isan. I hear they're in need of junglers in the playhouses along the trough.
You as well. I hear the city is suffering through a great dearth of undertakers.
I might even consider it if the pay wasn't such shit.
Isan smiled. The joke might have been low-hanging fruit, but humor from Kiral was rare as summer rain.
As you know, I've been looking into Nalame.
Here's something most interesting happened. Kiral blinked. His nostrils flared. His cheeks actually flushed. It was a momentary thing. There one moment, gone the next. But Isan had seen it. Kiral had looked nervous. He must be interested in Nalame as well. But why? Something must have precipitated it. Isan decided to share the truth, to see how Kiral would react.
Based on the visions he recorded, I suspect she will return soon. I could learn more if my access was unfettered.
For a moment, Kiral seemed to consider it. He was on the verge of agreeing, but then his look of indecision vanished.
Detail all you found and send it to me tomorrow, along with the journals.
Of course, my lord king. Forgive me for asking, but why the sudden interest? Has something happened?
When a third cart left, pushed by a stocky spear with a bulbous nose, Kiral turned to follow him.
Yusam once told me of the fall of Ishak and the Moonless Host. It's high time I found out more.
A lie, or at least not the whole truth.
And when you're done?
Kiral didn't stop.
It may take some time, Isan, he said, and swept from the room.
Some time, Isan thought. He means they'll never be available. It smacked of something other than Kiral imposing his will simply to show that he could. Whatever had happened, it had been recent.
Secrets, Isan thought, and me without my King of Whispers.
Which gave Isan his next destination. He made his way to Zaheb's palace, and was forced to wait for nearly an hour before the two of them could speak. Eventually, he was led by Drogon, Zaheb's clever young vizier, to the throne room. Using the brass knocker in the shape of a grinning demon, Drogon knocked thrice, and then moved to a table beside the gilded doors. On it were a dozen lamps. Drogon chose one of the smallest, lit it, then opened the rightmost door and led Isan into the dark, cavernous room. Even though the sound was strangely deadened, Drogon clicked the door shut behind him, taking pains to ensure the door did not clatter. It was daytime, and yet the throne room was dark as night. The only source of illumination was Drogon's tiny lamp, which revealed precious little save the patterns on the carpets. This space had been bright once, centuries ago, a grand vaulted room with high windows. Now, it was perpetually dark. Heavy curtains were draped over the windows, and along the walls as well, hiding the stone completely. The floor was covered from one end to the other in layers of carpets. Only in the vaulting recesses above could any stone be seen, and even those were obscured by bolts of orange and yellow cloth.
I feel like I've been swallowed whole, Isan said to Drogon, but it was a voice ahead in the darkness that answered, Yes, yes, it's dark, like a dragon's cave. Do you have to mention it every time you come?
As they approached, a man sitting cross-legged on the carpets appeared from the darkness. Zaheb, sitting on a mound of pillows before a low table. His eyes were closed. His hands were on his knees,
his palms upturned like an ascetic in the mountains of Morea. Isan laughed.
Gojin could craft demons in here, and no one would stare. An army could do battle and not a soul would come to investigate.
Drogon set the lamp on the table before Zaheb, then strode away, his footsteps silent as fog. Zaheb finally opened his eyes.
It's also quiet enough that if I strangled you, no one would hear it.
You sure?
The place was deadly quiet.
Have you ever tested it?
Zaheb's reply was humorless.
I'm willing to try if you are.
Isan lowered himself into the pillows opposite Zaheb.
Another time, perhaps.
Taking up the bottle of arak sitting there, he poured two helpings and slid one toward Zaheb. Zaheb didn't take it at first, but then his posture relaxed. He sank deeper into the pillows and took the glass. He downed it in one gulp, then poured himself another.
I'm surprised you're here.
Words seemed to be warring within him, but then he seemed to come to some decision.
What do you want, Isan?
A rather curious reaction.
There are a few things I wonder if the King of Whispers has got wind of.
He sipped his arak, a silvery liquid thick with the taste of pear and lychee and freshly churned butter that finished with strong notes of tobacco.
I've been reading Yusan's journals, hoping to learn when Nalame might reappear. Today, however, Kiral forbade me from reading them.
Zaheb frowned.
Denied you outright? Not in so many words. He took many of the journals I wanted and asked that I deliver those in my palace to him, further implying that access to them will be severely restricted. Well, we both know that when Kiral's eye lands on some new bauble, he doesn't rest until he has it. In this case, however,
Isan replied,
it's something that concerns us all. He's looking for something in particular. I'm certain of it. And likely to do with Nalame. What's your point?
My point, my good king, is that something has happened recently to cause Kiral to do this.
And?
And? I would think the King of Whispers would want to know something about it.
There was a look of sour disappointment on Zaheb's eyes, even disgust.
We agreed that we would no longer work against Kiral.
We did, but this is important. We deserve to know what he thinks will happen to us and to Sharakai.
Ah, so if you had learned of it, you would have shared it with the others?
Isan paused and chose his next words with care.
That would depend on the nature of the information.
Which is, you must admit, precisely Kiral's point of view.
Meaning that it's your point of view as well.
Perhaps it is, he said flatly. Which brings me to another order of business. You agreed that we would bide our time. You agreed to step in line with Kiral's wishes.
There is wisdom in your words,
I believe you said. Your visit here, would you call it wise, given the dangers we face from within our own house?
Can two kings not talk?
Zaheb snorted.
You may have played Yusan for a fool, Isan. You may have done so with me for a time. But that ends today.
He made a hand sign, the sort the Blade Maidens used to communicate with one another. Isan had never made a study of them, but he knew the sign for attack when he saw it. With the floor carpeted as it was, and the gloom that filled the cavernous space, he neither saw nor heard the kestrel until she was practically on top of him. She wore a rust-colored dress, a matching turban with a veil covering all but her eyes. Emerging from the darkness, she looked like a freshly made wound that grew by the moment.